يقولون سلام سلام ولا هنا سلام.
You're listening to Middle East Analysis, a podcast series taking a close look at the Middle East North Africa region. Hello and welcome to Middle East Analysis. Well, Middle East Analysis bite size, I would say. Now, a huge apology to our listeners because we are careering towards the end of February and we haven't spoken to you in 2015, which is why, through the grace of God, that I do have Dr. Harry Hagopian sitting opposite me, our regular studio guest on all things Middle East North Africa. Harry, I feel like saying Happy New Year, even though we're nearly in March.
Yes, I did the same thing, James, today when I came in and I spoke with the lady sitting at reception and I said, do I now have to tell you Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year, or have I already done that? And she said, you haven't. So then I realized, really, it's been 6+ weeks and into the new year and we haven't yet managed to do a podcast. But as you say, through the grace of God, plus London Transport, we both managed to get into the Bishop's Conference and into your nice studio.
Never the twain will meet, maybe those two things. Harry, it's great to have you with us. And as I say, we aren't going to go into massive in-depth analysis here on any singular topic. We've got two or three areas that I'd like us to cover, if that's okay.
Just to alert our listeners to some of the things that are happening, a couple of thoughts perhaps. After such a long absence, there's no point going into a PhD level analysis at the moment. So let's just touch a few of those issues that you and I think are quite interesting for the MENA region.
I think we shall do that. So let's forge on ahead with that. I might just trail ahead, though, because, yes, it's the London bus theory. We're talking public transport. You haven't had one for a couple of months, and now you're going to get two, because in a week's time, we're going to get our very own chair of international affairs in this very studio, because obviously we have our annual visit to the Holy Land, where
Absolutely.
Bishops from around the world go to the Holy Land to stand in solidarity.
Majestically known as the Holy Land Coordination Group.
Majestically, exactly. So we will have the majestic Bishop Declan Lang of Clifton, our Chair of International Affairs, sitting alongside you there. And I think we'll focus more on Gaza and the Holy Land. So listeners, it is deliberate that we aren't going to do so today.
Yeah, I think it would be a pleasure for the both of us to welcome Bishop Declan to join me on that podcast. And yes, the focus will be largely on Gaza. And as part of the Holy Land coordination trip, Bishop Declan was also in Gaza only a month ago. So he brings with him a fresh perspective. There have been other colleagues from the Catholic Bishops Conference who were there as well. So I'm sure you're going to do your technical wizardry, James, in order to make the podcast more interesting than just two voices droning on and then you interjecting every now and then.
Yes, no droning. Now you're getting into politics. Yes, we probably won't mention droning, or maybe we will. So let's, Harry, start with Syria. Now, it's been interesting because if you look at the international media, our very own BBC is included in this. Jeremy Bowen seems to have spoken to Bashar al-Assad and has had some choice things to say. It's been carved up for the BBC website and spread around the place. I'd like your views on that. Jonathan Tipperman from Foreign Affairs magazine as well has done a fairly wide-ranging interview. Perhaps we can say that we would have expected the answers that Bashar al-Assad gave in those two interviews. No such thing as barrel bombs and so on and so forth. Defending his position to fight terrorists, as obviously he's been calling them for 3 years now.
You ain't with me, you're simply against me.
Yeah, indeed. So I'd like to start with your views on the sort of, you know, there's the president opening up, perhaps, you know, trying to win some support from the West. What's your view on that initially?
It's interesting, James, because first let me share with our listeners my piece, Two Wrongs Do Not Make One Right, which you've got, and hopefully you'll put it on the website as well, which says a lot about what is happening in Syria and my own observations of it. Coming back to the interviews that President Bashar al-Assad did with both Jeremy Bowen, whom I like personally and I've known for many, many, many long years. In fact, it goes back to the Oslo years in Jerusalem, where we used to meet and have a drink at the American Colony Hotel just outside the walls of Jerusalem. He's a wonderful journalist, very sharp, as is Jonathan Tepperman from the Foreign Affairs. And what I thought was happening is quite clear. There's been a lot of speculation about those interviews, and a lot of people, whether they know what they're talking about or not, have expressed opinions on what is President Bashar al-Assad doing. What I would say is, I don't think necessarily, and I might be wrong, but I don't think that the man is in denial. The man is simply denying anything that doesn't suit his own idea of what should happen in Syria. And there is a difference between being in denial and denying. One is more unconscious than the other. And I think that he is not delusional either. He might not be fully briefed and informed of everything happening on the ground, but I would be very, very surprised if he doesn't realize all those barrel bombs that are being thrown at civilians across different parts of Syria. And I cannot believe that he would sort of look and say, what barrel bombs, and then do one of the most limp jokes, or perhaps callous jokes for that matter, where he puts barrel bombs and cooking pots in the same sentence. I don't think he's delusional. I don't think he's in denial. I think he is simply denying the facts. Why? Because, and why those two successive interviews with foreign journalists after a long absence of so many months and even years, I believe. First, because I think he feels stronger. He feels in a stronger position. He feels that the tide is turning, that he is actually in a position where he is slightly more in control of parts of the country than he was a year ago, and certainly 2 years ago. But it is also because, and he hinted at that quite broadly during the interview with Jeremy, is that he believes that he is now fighting the same fight like the Americans and others against Daesh or ISIL. And therefore, he thinks that he's now on the side of the Europeans and the Americans versus those Islamist radicals. Of course, I don't believe that. And if you read my article, which I know you have, you will realize that I call what his regime has done as much as what Daesh or ISIL have done as two horrendous bloodbaths that have been thrown at a hapless, poor Syrian people. Men, women, and children. So I think he feels stronger. He's denying what he doesn't like, but otherwise he's being extremely jovial, smiling. Let's not forget, he lived in this country, and therefore he knows how to deal with Westerners. And I think that he's going to be there for a while. What I would say, and I think just to make this very brief, because we're running through a few topics, you and I, what I would say is, we really should start thinking about what we want to do in Syria. And when we say we, I mean we in the West. I still believe that the U.S. administration policy on Syria is a big vacuum, a big zero. And we in the West are sort of jumping from one tactical move to another without actually having a real strategy for Syria. I think now, and I've changed a bit my views, but that's only normal. That's not because my views were wrong. It's only that my views now take into factor what is happening today on the ground. That Bashar al-Assad's regime and everybody and everything associated with him cannot simply be thrown out for the sake of restoring democracy in the country. He and his regime will play a part in the transition, in the handover. But a handover there should be, and a transition there should be, because just like I cannot for the life of me imagine Daesh having a future in Syria, let alone in Iraq and the larger region, I cannot imagine him having one either after all that has happened with well over 200,000 dead in the country to date. Final point on this, James. One thing I would have loved Jeremy to do, and I know that he didn't do it because he thought that he was only given 25 minutes. If he'd been given a little longer, he might have waded into the what about the future? I mean, a lot was said about the past. A lot of questions were asked, and some were robust questions. My hat off to Jeremy for having the guts to ask him those questions repeatedly. But what was absent from the interview is what happens next. What about the future? It's all barrel bombs, blood, ISIL, this, that, and the other, but not about the future. Hopefully, we will be able to talk about the future, and we will not now be so taken up by the Ukraine that we will forget about the MENA region.
Now, If I was going to expand, I could ask you your views on the future, but I think we'll hold that because otherwise we'll be here all day.
Absolutely.
And I do want to talk about a few other countries.
And read my article, as you have, and some of my views are embedded in that article.
Now, this is going to sound a bit sycophantic, listeners, but do read it because it is very good. I would actually, Harry, say it's, I mean, they're all good, but it's definitely one of the best ones I've read in some time. I think it's a fantastic article.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Coming from you, I appreciate that because I know that you're quite careful about how you rate writings.
It's excellent. I think it's accessible too, which
Thank
is
you.
A big thing. Let's move on to Egypt, because the story that probably can't have escaped us is that the remaining two Al Jazeera journalists have actually been, I suppose they've been freed, but I don't know on what conditions.
No, they have not been freed, James. They've
been
released on bail.
Right, they're released on bail. Now, of course, the Australian journalist was released maybe a week ago, was he now?
He was just over a week ago.
And was very vocal about the need to release the other two. So what are your views about, number one, the state of play in Egypt and the release of these journalists?
Well, to start with the state of play in Egypt in one or two very simple sentences, I think that what we're seeing at the moment is that the country is going back into another chapter of dictatorship, and it's dictatorship for the sake of security and stability. So after the revolution of 25th January, after all the ructions that took place, it seems that a lot of Egyptians are beginning to say, well, you know what, we need some quiet time, we need some security, and therefore the president and the government and the establishment in Egypt are actually at the moment being more stringent in their measures than those measures were under the previous President Hosni Mubarak, let alone the one-year interim with Morsi, who was the Muslim Brotherhood caption boy. So in that sense, I think we need to worry about where this is going to lead, because whilst at the moment it might Egypt might still be holding together, I'm not sure what the future bodes and whether it bodes well for Egypt. Look at what's happening in the Sinai Peninsula. All the Islamists and all the fighting that's taking place is only a foretaste of what could happen if things really become too restrictive and too repressive. James, it's simple. You take, my mother used to use what we used to call in Armenian, in Italian, a presto. A presto is not a piano term. A presto is a pressure cooker. Mm. Where it has a release valve at the top. She used to cook vegetables and stuff and meat in that presto. Now, if you'd close the release valve and you do not allow some steam to come out of that pressure cooker, eventually so much steam will be built into that pressure cooker that it will suddenly bang, the lid will come off, and then you will have food and steam and all sorts of things spluttering all over the kitchen.
Which
the same is true of a state.
Is that not what happened over three, four decades with the Mubarak regime?
Absolutely. It's what happened over three, four decades across the whole Arab world and the whole MENA region, Egypt being one of them. Now, coming back again to a more specific question, which is the Al Jazeera journalists. Peter Greste, the Australian, has returned to Brisbane. And the other two stayed in jail for a while longer. Now they've been released, one on bail and one without bail, but the trial resumes on the 23rd of February. The question is simple. They were all charged with assisting the Muslim Brotherhood. Fair enough. Now, what I don't understand as a lawyer is that if the charges are the same for all three, and one is an Australian now in Australia, one is an Egyptian, also Canadian citizenship, and he has given up his Egyptian citizenship and kept his Canadian one in the hope that he now becomes a foreigner and he's deported to Canada, whereas the third chap, the poor man, only has an Egyptian passport, so he can't really go elsewhere. But if all three were facing the same charges, then what kind of legal acrobatics and jurisprudence, what kind of rules of evidence would allow one of them to be deported? Oh, you're okay, go home, whereas the other two are still kept in jail and now they're going to go back to trial. It's all political, but there again, like the pressure cooker, pressure is building on President el-Sisi and the government to do something, because every single human rights organization, every single person, every single lawyer is saying this is not right, and therefore now they're trying desperately to find a way to get out of this morass. And my guess is, and this is another one of my non-prophetic thoughts, that whilst they're saying, okay, the trial resumes on the 23rd of February, they will find ways of prolonging it. People lose interest, and then suddenly the charges would be dropped, and these people would have suffered for no reason at all, except that they spoke out against the regime.
Well, it makes you wonder that if there's another 3 or 4 decades of this particular strong rule, military rule, it may be the same as Mubarak. But we'll move on, really, from this one.
You know what? A lot of very well-connected and veteran observers of the MENA region are saying, and I do subscribe to this, we haven't seen the end of the Arab Spring. The Arab Spring might have died out. It might even have led to a winter rather than lead to summer. So it has reversed seasons a bit. However, a lot of people would tell you this is not the end of the story. The story has begun and it is going to continue. Or, to put it in my own pictorial way, as you and I used to say often, James, the genie is out of the bottle. It is still out of the bottle, but the problem is we neither can get hold of the genie, nor are we sure what to do with the bottle itself.
Interesting. I think further conversation on this one over the coming months.
There you go.
Let's move on to Libya, because I know you wanted to talk about Libya. I've got a bit of a personal interest. I have friends from Libya. Ooh, the place scares me, to be frank, and I've never been there, but as an observer, the place scares me. And you wanted to mention the abduction of the 21... Coptic Egyptians.
Yes, again, we're not going to go into too much of a conversation at the moment, but I like the Libyan people and I like their temperament. I also know Libya fairly well. What I wanted to focus on are two things. One, I wanted to throw out an alert, a danger signal. If we look at places like Derna, like Benghazi, the second largest city in Libya. If we look now at places like Sirte, these places are beginning to show signs of ISIL or Daesh beginning to establish itself in Libya. It's establishing itself in Libya, or trying to do so, for a variety of reasons. One is because it is having problems in Syria and certainly in Iraq. And therefore, by the nature of how it thinks of itself and the way it constantly morphs into something else, it is looking at the whole region. So it's probably got Libya in its target, in its vision as well. The other reason why this is happening is that Libya is not a religiously radicalized society, has not been. It's been tribal more than anything else. But now, with all those groups fighting each other, then this is creating so much tension in the country that it is producing those problems. So two things I would just direct our listeners to very, very quickly. One, our prayers and our thoughts should be with Bishop Angelos, the General Bishop of the Coptic Orthodox Church in the United Kingdom, as well as the Coptic Church, both hierarchy, but equally importantly for me, and I underline this, the people themselves, not only the hierarchy counts, who are actually agonizing with all those abducted, kidnapped Coptic Egyptians who are held, and there is a threat that they might actually be decapitated or killed as well. Our thoughts with them. This is yet another example, another symptom of what the region is going through and of Daesh or ISIL's thuggery and ruthlessness. The second thing I would say on Libya, if anybody really wants to know more about Libya, then of course you can do lots of things. You can read stuff, you can go into social media, you can also listen or read people like very good journalists like Mary Fitzgerald and Rana Jawad, who are actually reporting from Libya. But what I would also say is that a new book, spanking new book, has come out by Hearst Publishers here in London, called The Libyan Revolution and Its Aftermath, which is edited by Brian, by a couple of people, I think, actually. And it's got different contributions from different people. I would suggest that people go onto Amazon's site or onto their internet or onto their bookshops and get a copy if they're interested in Libya, because it talks a lot about what is happening there and it makes it easier for us to understand a country that often is way outside our political space.
Well, we can put a link up to that as well. If you
we
think
can.
It's a valuable publication worth reading.
It is
reading,
indeed.
Then
and
we
there was
do that.
A launch of that book only a few days ago at King's College here in London.
We shall do that. Now, I've at the very start of this podcast, if you remember, I declared this a Middle East analysis bite size. We've taken a bit of a chunk there. That we've taken a proper mouthful.
Oh, dear.
But that's fine, because it's been very interesting, and I certainly appreciate you coming in. Very busy man, as always. But that's it, Harry, for today. Thank you ever so much. We've really gone around the houses, hopefully not gone into too much depth, but given you enough to ponder, listeners. I found it very interesting. And, Harry, we will be joined by you in a matter of a week
days.
Or so. Yeah, yeah. So we'll have you back. We'll look forward to it. We'll keep our eye on at Harry Hagopian, your Twitter account, so our listeners will probably notice when they see your article that you referred to on epectarsis.net or indeed our site, that you did reference your eccentric Twitter usage.
So. I did. You know what? I have fun with my Twitter. I don't look at it as a tool of self-promotion. I probably should, but I don't. I look at it as just a source of information for people who want to separate the chaff from the wheat.
Well, that's how I look at it, too. So,
wonderful.
Listeners, at Harry Hagopian, at Catholic EW, if you'd like to check out our stuff here at the Bishop's Conference. Yes, do stay with us, because we will have that really interesting podcast on Gaza and the Holy Land.
And we'll have that podcast, by the way, James, after Shrove Tuesday and when we are already in the Lenten period.
A good period for that podcast.
Absolutely.
I would say, or the consumption of it. So,
absolutely.
Harry, thank you ever so much. Really
pleasure.
Appreciate your time. And we'll be back with you, listeners, very soon indeed.